thank you all for coming. Welcome to the Adam Art Gallery. My name's Jeff Batchen. I'm the co-curator along with Tina Barton, who's gesticulating to me at the back of the Dark Sky exhibition. And as you know, we've had a number of lunchtime conversations through the course of the exhibition looking at different aspects of it, focusing on particular works in the show and trying to bring together kind of interdisciplinary conversations, pairs of people from different disciplinary backgrounds, to try and broaden the conversation just beyond art and even beyond photography, to look at the whole question of how we represent the skies, what they mean to us, how even through history those representations have shifted and changed. Today we're very fortunate to have with us William Tobin, sitting here beside me, British-born, now retired and living in France, but in an earlier life teaching, teaching in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Canterbury, sharing his expertise on observational astronomy. But as it happens, William also has a particular interest and expertise in the 19th century history of astronomy. He has written books about important French pioneers in the photographing of the heavens. And so he's particularly well placed to talk today, or to focus today, our attention on the Hermann Cronje images, which are downstairs in the gallery. Originally, we were thinking we'd start down there and then walk back here, because we were kind of anxious to show you some projected images as well. What we're hoping to do is have a conversation for this hour, and that you'll be so inspired that you'll want to go back down the stairs and look at the Cronje images again, perhaps for the first time in detail, with perhaps a greater understanding of exactly what those panels represent. I should just say that Tina and I were particularly thrilled to be loaned those panels. We were a bit shocked, actually. The Cronje archive exists in Dresden. And really, there hasn't been much attention placed on Cronje outside of Germany itself. He's a very prominent photographer within Germany. But in the outside world, he's not so well known. And yet, he's a very interesting character. And he's particularly interesting for our purposes because he came here to New Zealand in 1874, specifically to photograph the transit of Venus of that year. And as I'm sure you're all aware, lightning flashed at 4 a.m. this morning, if you were unlucky enough to be awake. And at about 10:30 this morning, we had so-called first contact, when the orb of Venus first touched the outer circumference of the Sun, and it's currently working its way across the face of the Sun. We couldn't stream it live down here because the little room is protected from Wi-Fi, but you can see it upstairs where the attendant is sitting if you haven't yet seen it. Obviously, we live in Wellington, so we just take for granted we can't actually see it live. And indeed, I'm sure the Germans were extremely nervous in 1874 when they were down there on the Auckland Islands, wondering whether it would be cloudy that day or not. But I brought a few images to share with you, just to give you a little bit of background before I ask William a few pointed questions. And he also has some images to try and put the whole transit experience into a bigger historical context. I just wanted to point out the difficulty of photographing things like the transit, or for that matter, the moon, was evident from the earliest days of photography. Louis Daguerre, the inventor of the daguerreotype, we have reports made or attempted to make a photograph of the moon in January of 1839, the same month in which he announced his invention of photography. So right from the beginning, the moon and the stars and the planets were imagined subjects for photography. But this gives you a sense of the problem. If you simply point your camera up in the air with the relatively slow exposure time that comes with daguerreotype technology, the moon, in fact the Earth, of course, moves under your feet, and so the moon appears simply as a smear of light on your photographic plate. Of course, we're an ingenious species, and it wasn't long before people overcame this problem basically by turning their telescopes into clockwork mechanisms that tracked the moon through the sky. So we seem to be seeing a photograph of the moon, a daguerreotype again, captured in a particular instant, when in fact what we're looking at is a durational image, a composite, if you like, of the moon as it tracks through the sky. And this kind of conflation of space and time is a particular characteristic, you might say, of astronomical photography that I'm sure William's going to want to tell us more about as we move along. As you probably know, if you've read the catalogue, expeditions were sent out by national governments all over the world to photographically record the transit of 1874. And the German government decided to send, among other expeditions, one to the Auckland Islands off the south coast of New Zealand. And among the eight members of the team was this man, seen here, of course, in younger years, Hermann Kroner, a prominent German photographer. Here he's with his very big lens, as you can see. And they landed in the unfortunately named Terra Cove and set up camp, having first stopped in Melbourne to buy some demountable buildings, which they quickly erected in the cove. You can see in the foreground here a couple of members of the expedition and then further members back against the tents or other huts in the background there. William knows almost too much about this expedition, so I'm just giving you an overview and then he'll correct me when his turn comes. But you can see that they set up various buildings, including demountable observatories with telescopes in them. And you can see also the kind of wildness of the terrain that they encountered. As you probably know, the Auckland Islands have never been permanently settled. There have been attempted settlements that failed for one reason or another, but it's been regularly visited by whalers and other kinds of passing ships. So it's a pretty desolate place. And you can see that desolation in many of the photographs that Kroner himself took while the expedition was there, which are gathered in these panels down the stairs. Here's the inside of one of the telescopic observatory. I presume they're the cylindrical buildings that we see in the overview.
Yes, yeah.
And these telescopes were, of course, hooked up to cameras. Again, William might know much more about it than I do. What's interesting about the Kroner photographs is the way in which they have survived. As you can see, they're gathered here in the exhibition and here in these slides on these panels, these numbered panels. And you can see, for example, he's put together a panorama of Terra Cove looking out, if you like, from their dwellings out to sea and the ship that brought them there. And various, he was obviously very interested in the locale. William, since he's been able to see them in the flesh, has been noticing the number of botanical photographs, particular interest in particular species of tree that Kroner photographed over and over again. So he obviously did have an interest in the locale. And when you see these photographs, those of us that haven't been to the Auckland Islands, you are very much struck by the wildness of the place, obviously the wind that affects these trees and so on. There's also some pretty poignant elements. If you look in the top row, you can see some gravestones. I think William was telling me that the tombstone, the gravestone one there, was for a three-month-old who died during the effort to establish a permanent settlement on the island. So there's some pretty kind of poignant elements to these photographs. And as I said, the landscape itself is pretty forbidding in Kroner's photographs. The interesting thing about the expedition was that, as it happens, Kroner wasn't the only photographer on the team. There was also another man named Wolfram who also took a series of photographs, mostly of the landscape. These are both, we think, by Wolfram. So we have a fair amount of documentation of the expedition itself. On the day of the transit, which I think was December 9 that year, wasn't it?
Something like that. In this time zone, yes.
In 1874. He, of course, anxiously made photographs of the transit. What's interesting is that when they got to the island, he discovered that the local water supply was mostly tainted by iron oxide, thus creating a difficulty in the taking of the photographs, because the kind of process that he was going to use, a collodion on glass process, required constant washing with clean water. Faced with this problem, he rapidly came up with a solution, which was a process that he invented on the spot, which only required one wash with distilled water, which he called the Auckland dry process. So in effect, he invented his own photographic process, a modification of an existing technology, but still a New Zealand invented on New Zealand soil in order to photograph both the New Zealand landscape and what could be seen from it. And here we have a panel. He was actually well known as an astronomical photographer even before 1874. He made one of the first daguerreotypes of an eclipse, I think, or something like that. So he was already well known for this kind of expertise. And here we have one of the only two surviving paper photographs printed from the glass plates that he would have exposed in 1874, the one on the right here, plus, I feel like, a reverse print on the other side. It's interesting for me how symmetrically he's organized these panels, and he's included in this particular panel, which is of course devoted to astronomical photography in general, a number of other pictures that he was involved with through his career. Now, the thing is that these panels were put together, in fact, in 1909. Here we see Kroner on the left with the panels around him as part of a huge international exposition devoted to photography. And as a veteran and important local photographer, the exhibition was held in Dresden, he was invited to put together a history of photography using his own collections as the basis for them. As a consequence, he put together these panels, which began with daguerreotypes that he'd taken in the 1840s, all the way up through to the early 20th century, tracking the history of photography. And of course, three of the panels were devoted to the photographs he took on or from the Orkney Islands. So here we have one of the first big international exhibitions devoted to photography, where New Zealand, perhaps for the only time in our history, was prominently represented. Here's the detail. So I'm going to, just while we have this detail up, perhaps ask William to talk a bit about exactly what this expedition and other expeditions like it in 1874 were trying to do. They're obviously wanting to record the transit. What does that mean? What were they wanting to measure? What calculations were made on the basis of these photographs? Could you explain some of that?
Well, perhaps it would be good if I go to some of the slides in...
In your one?
In my one, because...
Okay. Well, in that case, let me just finish and come back. Because I just wanted to mention another thing beside the Kroner panels we have in the exhibition is a diagram from an 1890s book published by Etienne Jules Marie. And what's interesting about that is that the French sent an expedition to Japan in 1874, headed by a man named Janssen. And in order to record the transit using, Janssen decided to use the daguerreotype, which had been superseded for 20 years at that point. But it was imagined that because daguerreotypes are relatively dry plates, there was less likely that the plate itself would shrink, and therefore any calculations made of them would be more accurate. So they, in effect, reinvented the daguerreotype process. And he also invented a special instrument to expose these daguerreotypes, in which he could turn the back of the instrument you see on the left here. You can see they're actually photographing a reflection of the transit. And the plates were circular. And so the gun, he called it basically a photographic gun. He would turn it in the back. And what you get, as you can see, here's the mechanism, would be a series of segmented photographs showing the small black dot of Venus crossing the arc of the sun in this sort of segmented way so that you could match space to time. Now, William was just telling me that he's not sure whether these daguerreotypes that we have are actually of the transit or of models. In other words, whether these were test plates or the actual plates exposed.
This is clearly a test plate because it says at the bottom, artificial transit of Venus across the...
There you go. No wonder it's so nice. The interesting thing about these things is that Marie got wind of it, wrote to Janssen and asked for the specifications, and then built a modified version of this photographic gun so that it could go much faster with faster exposure times. And that's basically the basis of the cine camera that, of course, is at the heart of our movie industry today and, of course, supports through Sir Peter Jackson, order of something or other, the Wellington economy to this day. Let me just close mine and pull up our PDF here.
Okay, that's the end.
Yeah. How do we get back to? Now, I'm going to swap seats and let you drive.
Give me the problem. Okay. So let me see everything in reverse. Control L will make that full screen.
The
astronomy, of course, has evolved a lot. And if we go back to, say, the time of Galileo, who was the first person to point a telescope at the sky, he actually made some observations which were no more than simple pen and ink drawings. And here at the bottom, you can see ink drawings of Saturn. He didn't understand at all what he was seeing. I think he described Saturn as having ears. But nevertheless, a lot of observations were not in image form at all. It was a matter of measuring positions of stars in the sky. And what you actually got, as you can see in one of these pages from the Rudolphine tables of Kepler, is actually just had tabulations and tabulations of numbers. As telescopes became more powerful and people's interest moved from just how stars move or how how the planets move in the sky to what actually it is that we're seeing in the sky, people began devising telescopes that would be better for looking through. And Lord Ross, who was an Irish peer with lots of money, spent a large fraction of his fortune building large telescopes. And he, for instance, with this drawing, discovered that there were objects in the sky that seemed to have a spiral structure, fuzzy objects in the sky that had a spiral structure. But photography, ultimately, during the end of the 19th century and the 20th century, was very important in astronomy. It's not really important in astronomy anymore, as I'll say a bit later on. But the Jeff talked about photographing the moon. The moon was initially really the only thing you could hope to photograph, because the stars were too faint and the sun was too bright. The moon was just right in the middle. Nevertheless, the sun was a possibility. And these two men, Foucault and Fizeau, and I've written a biography of Foucault, in 1844 and 45, were set to work by the director of the Paris Observatory to try to photograph the sun. And the technological thing they really had to do that, was to make a fast shutter, because with the photographs of the moon we saw, essentially there would have been a telescope with a lens cap, and someone would have taken the lens cap off for a few seconds and then put it back on. For the sun, you needed to have an exposure of a hundredth of a second. And what these two men did was they actually had a falling shutter that with a little slit in it that went across the photographic plate.
Sort of a guillotine.
Yes, sort of thing, that allowed a rapid exposure. And this is the one plate of many that they took that has survived. And you can actually see three rather large sunspots on it. You can also see that the edge of the sun is dimmer than the centre, which had long been suspected and was sort of confirmed with this photograph. And so the first photography of the sky, really, in any systematic and professional sense, was of the sun. This man, De La Rue, and I think his company still prints our banknotes, or maybe not now, they're plastic. But anyway, he devised a photoheliograph, so a telescope for photographing the sun with a lens at one end, in fact, a magnifying lens in the middle or towards the end, and a place where you put the photographic plate. And from around about the end of the 1850s, in fact, at Kew in London, there was a systematic program of taking daily photographs of the sun, and the British have just finished digitising all 22,000 plates. But to move on to the transit of Venus, transits of Venus are fairly rare. We all know that in 1769, Cook came to Tahiti to measure the transit of Venus, and that was the second of a pair. There was one in 1761 and one in 1769. And then there were no transits till 1874 and 1882. So this was the next transit, 1874, after Cook. Now, what was the interest of measuring transits of Venus? Because, as Jeff said, European powers, the United States as well, sent numerous expeditions around the world to measure this this phenomenon. Why were they interested in spending so much money? Well, the simple answer was they were trying to get the distance to the sun with a low uncertainty, with high accuracy. And the way that they were trying to do this was essentially what's known as the method of parallax. They weren't going to look at the sun, they were going to look at Venus, which at the time was the object that was known to come closest to the Earth, and therefore your measurement was likely to be most accurate. They were trying to look at Venus from two different points on the Earth's surface, as the diagram on the left shows you, and from the difference in angle from the two different points, you could work out how far away Venus was. And in fact, Kepler, when he had studied planetary motions, had produced laws of planetary motion which had resulted in a map of the solar system where you had the map but you didn't know what the scale was. So you knew that Venus orbited around the sun with a radius of about 3/4 of the orbit of the Earth, and that Mars was 1.5 times further away from the sun, but you didn't know how many kilometres those corresponded to. So if you could measure any distance in this map without a scale, you had the scale of the whole map. So really it was the scale of the solar system, but conventionally
astronomers talked about what they called the solar parallax, which was another way of saying the distance to the sun. On the other hand, the distance of the sun just in itself wasn't worth sending. Here on the map you see the red spots, all the expeditions that were sent in 1874, order of 100 of them. The real point about getting the distance of the sun, it was needed for predictions of the motions of the planets, and particularly accurate predictions of the motion of the moon, which was important at that time, although it was beginning to decline in importance, for determining longitudes and determining and navigating at sea. And of course, being able to navigate at sea was of immense economic importance, that your ships didn't run aground on the rocks and so on. So if you want to do this, you can see you'll get a bigger angle to measure if you have observing sites far apart. And so you try and spread your observing sites all over the visible, all over that part of the Earth that will see the transit, because for some people the transit is at night. And the Germans had 6 expeditions, one of which went to the Auckland Islands. So in fact, in this neck of the woods, here are the expeditions that came in 1874. The Americans, for instance, had set up a headquarters in Queenstown. They also had observers on Chatham Island and in Tasmania. The Germans went to Auckland Islands. The French went to Campbell Island. The British had their headquarters in Burnham and recruited a whole load of locals who were mostly surveyors to observe elsewhere in New Zealand as well, including two observers here in Wellington.
Can I just ask quickly, yeah, are there photographs surviving, for example, the French expedition in Canada?
So the French had the barest glimpse. They did better than we are today, but hardly any better. I think actually there are two German plates that survive in paper copy. And there's one in a book as well, reproduced in the book, which is a different plate again.
We should say that Kronev did successfully expose 115 glass plates.
Yes.
But the originals were all destroyed during the bombing campaigns in the Second World War.
Yes.
So what we have left are these paper copies.
Yes. I recently, i.e. about 3 weeks ago, discovered two of the British plates, taken at Burnham. They took, I think, about a dozen before the rain came in. So in fact, if you do a Google search on me, or if you look at Radio New Zealand's Saturday morning website, you'll see those two plates online. The Americans were most successful at Queenstown, but both, in fact, the Americans and the Germans, once they'd taken their plates, they duplicated them. They made copies of the plates are negative, they made positive copies, and the United States sent half of this duplicate set back by separate ships to the United States, so if one ship sank, they'd still have the other. The Germans did the same, as I'll mention a little bit later on. Anyway, so they went to the Auckland Islands. Now, if you're not familiar with the geography of the Auckland Islands, it's a couple of volcanic cones, so it's a bit like the Banks Peninsula. And they went up to the top, to Port Ross, to this sort of double cove called Terra Cove. And when you see some of the photographs of it, you realise that the little promontory between the two bits is actually really quite small. And to call the whole thing Terra Cove is reasonable enough. And I suppose they partly, I'm not quite sure whether they went there because the transit was actually in the afternoon, so they needed to look to the north and the northwest. So it's not particularly that they had an open skyline, but the island isn't very high, so it must have been all right. So here's one of the photographs of the 8 members of the expedition that came from Germany. In fact, they recruited 3 more. They travelled by commercial boat, either through the Suez Canal or around the Cape of Good Hope, depending on how elevated they were in the power structure, met up in Melbourne, where after some difficulty they managed to hire a French sailing ship, to take them to the Auckland Islands. But these are the 8 that came from Germany. And so we have Hermann Kroner, the photographer, as we see, he had his son with him who turned 21 on Auckland Islands. And then Guido Wolfram was the other photographer who subsequently went on to become a chemical manufacturer. And so exits from the history of astronomy. So as Geoffrey said, there are these panels that were put together. I've included a couple of the other panels to show them here at the bottom with the ones in blue cyanotype, or what we'd call a blueprint of the photographic process, or up here at the right showing the effects of different times and toning preparations on this picture of a woman. So here indeed is one of the pictures by Wolfram, I do believe, of their installation. Now, one thing that's immediately interesting is that the ship, the French ship, is smeared. And that means this must be quite a long exposure. It's an exposure of several seconds. And that's, now by 1874, there was no real difficulty in having fast emulsions that would take, you could take an exposure in a fraction of a second. So I think here they are using the emulsion that they will have used for photographing the sun, where there was no need, because there was plenty of light, to have a fast emulsion. So this is the process invented on the Auckland Islands, which didn't need as much washing. But you can see there's the dome that I've marked, the sort of cylindrical dome that I've marked, photoheliograph dome. That was their one telescope which was designed for taking photographs, with the dark room next door. The other two domes you see to the left that I haven't marked had telescopes for optical, for visual timing of when the sun, the planet just moved onto the disk of the sun and was about to leave it. The hen house, which you can't actually see here, but I'll show you where it is, important because the photographic emulsion was based on albumen, on egg whites. And so the hens were there to provide the photographic plates, not to provide breakfast for the photographers. The British at Burnham... what do you do with the yolks, exactly? The British in Burnham possibly got an even better idea, because their process was the beer albumen process, and they needed, besides the eggs, they also needed supplies of beer. And indeed, I've just been looking at Archives New Zealand in Christchurch, and on the bills of lading for the railway, there is indeed a barrel of stout being sent out to the observers just a day or two before the transit, which is generally both for the Germans and the British, is when they actually prepared the photographic plates a day or two before they were going to need them. So here are photographs. Cronus' photograph of the photoheliograph is better than Wolfram's. You can see all the bottles of all the various chemicals in Cronus' photo that must have been used for both preparing the plates and fixing and washing the plates afterwards. Let me just say something a bit technical. The way the telescope is mounted, you can see there's two axes. There's a vertical axis and then there's a horizontal axis. So that means the telescope could move like this or it could move like that. And for an exposure that is so very rapid, because these must have been exposures of the order of a hundredth of a second, though I don't know exactly what it is, what the exposure was, you didn't need to drive the telescope to follow the stars. It wasn't the problem with the moon, where the moon being dimmer, you had to have a telescope that tracked to get an image that wasn't blurred. But it also is relevant to the interpretation of the photographs. The way the telescope was obviously pointed, you can see there's this little circular white screen with a telescope in front of it. They would have just projected the image of the sun and onto the screen to check that the telescope was pointing in the right direction. Now it gets just a little bit technical, so you didn't worry about this too much, but essentially if you have the sun and Venus in the sky, there was the lens at the top end of the telescope, which produced an image of the sun at a certain point. And there the Germans introduced a glass plate on which they'd ruled very carefully, scratched very carefully a grid of lines to superimpose on the solar image to help in measurements, and also these, if I can just point to them, these double lines here and here to actually be unambiguous about the orientation. And then they had another lens, a little camera lens, that magnified the image, because this image would only have been a few centimetres or so across, to an image that was more like 10 centimetres across, because the photographic images of the sun were 10 centimetres across, which is where you had the plates. And then you have to work out, okay, from which side are you seeing it? You always tend to look at a photographic plate from the emulsion side. They copied it by putting two emulsions together and shining light through. And then if you take a paper print, you may actually end up with a mirror image. So up here at the top, we have the paper print that's actually in the State Library of Victoria in Melbourne, because apart from the copies of these photographs that are in Dresden, some years afterwards, both photographers sent albums of their photographs to Melbourne, which had been their staging post, and they are still there. So this one is in fact back to front, and then when you read, thanks to Google Translate, the German, the 3,600 pages of reports of the 1874 and 1882 Transit of Venus expeditions, you discover which way round the reticle is. So you can actually work out how they saw it on the sky, and it looks, as I've just shown you there. And so with this issue of the original plate and the copy plate, in the panels upstairs, the one on the right is a print from an original plate, because we're seeing it with the sun bright and Venus dark, whereas the print on the left, where we see it in negative, is a print from a copy plate. And you can see that there, if you put them together, that one is the mirror image of the other, like my hands are the mirror image of each other. It's been stuck on the plate, on the photograph, in the way that they would have seen it had they seen it with their naked eye, from the Auckland Islands. And then if you're really clever, you can plot over where you think where Venus should have been, and you can work out that this plate was taken a little after 1600 hours New Zealand standard time, if we were to use New Zealand standard time, in the afternoon. The expedition actually used Port Ross mean time, an Auckland Island time. And as Jeff said, there were 115 plates taken, most of them in the first half of the transit because the weather then got poorer. And I've actually plotted as little red dots the 30 of the plates that were later deemed to be good and useful for their measurements. And this is not one of them. So perhaps not surprisingly, if the photographers were going to do something as frivolous as make albums, they were given the second plates, the ones that weren't of top quality, to play with. What the point was in trying to determine how, from the different locations on the Earth, the track of Venus was different on the Sun, was to measure accurately the position of Venus with respect to the Sun. And for the Germans, they were interested in doing it in two coordinates, both sort of horizontally and vertically. And so they put a lot of effort into knowing exactly where their grid is and how much the grid was actually not vertical, for example. Whereas the British decided that was too complicated to try and align everything very accurately. So they decided they'd just measure the distance between the centre of Venus and the centre of the Sun as what they were going to measure for their parallax method. The trouble with photography, everybody had great hopes in 1874 that photography was objective, it was going to, there'd be no doubt about the interpretation of the data. Unfortunately, because the exposures were very short, the turbulence in the Earth's atmosphere could produce an image of the planet Venus that was not round at all. And in fact, the image from the Auckland Islands that's reproduced in a textbook, the object is quite obviously sort of globule shaped. I mean, it's irregular. And so where's the center of that? The other difficulty is actually deciding where the edge of the sun is, because the edge of the sun sort of fades off in brightness and doesn't seem to have a nice sharp edge to determine where for measuring the edge. So in fact, photography really failed in 1874. And in 1882, when there was another attempt made at measuring the distance of the sun, by and large, everybody abandoned photography, and it was only visual observations that were made.
Why are visual observations more accurate?
Well, they weren't. they failed as well.
Because if I remember correctly, even Cook's observations had that same
problem. The black dot. Exactly. The aim of going to photography was to get away from this black dot effect. The fact that actually, at the moment, if you're measuring with your naked eye, what's easy to measure, or what's thought was easiest to measure, is the points at which the limbs of Venus and the Sun are just touching, either on the inside or the outside, either as Venus moves into the Sun or as Venus moves off the Sun. But it proved that actually determining, you had two observers side by side on Tahiti, because Cook wasn't the only person actually observing in Tahiti. They had an astronomer with him, and there were other members of the other officers, and they disagreed by 30 seconds as to this moment of contact.
Now, why does the time matter?
Well, the time matters because in the 18th century, the method that they were using was to try and time from one contact at one side of the sun to the contact at the other side of the sun, and that was actually a proxy for what the length was. In the 18th century, they didn't have very accurate clocks, but they could by looking at the stars and looking at their clocks, work out what rate their clock was advancing at. So they could measure intervals of time, the aim was to measure how long it took for Venus to cross the Sun. You needed to see the beginning and the end of the transit. And if you were at a different latitude, because your view was different from a different latitude, the track across the sun would be longer or shorter. There would be different chords across the sun. And so from the different lengths of those chords, which you measured by measuring the different amounts of time taken for Venus to go across those chords, you could work out what angle would separate those two tracks as seen from a known difference in distance on the Earth.
You knew how quickly Venus was travelling, so if you could measure the amount of time it took to cross the Sun, you could measure the distance or something. Is that how it...
That was it. Unfortunately, I haven't got on these ones a relevant... I haven't got the appropriate... Well, let me just show it here. Essentially, if you have a different sort of... If you think of it in a different way, you can straighten out this track so you don't have it bent. So if you imagine you've got two straight tracks coming across the sun, and from, say, one observatory you'd see a track like that, and then from another observatory you'd see a track like that, which is longer, it therefore takes longer for this observatory from that observatory. And for instance, today's transit lasts 10 minutes longer in Japan than it lasts in Wellington, because Japan is further north, and therefore the track of the Japanese sea is actually closer to the southern edge of the sun and is shorter. It's longer. So what you're using is you're using time, and you were able to measure time intervals in the 18th century as a proxy for length. And then with your two known lengths, say this one and that one, you can work out what circle goes across through the four points. You work out what angle separates your two tracks, and since you knew how far apart your two observatories were on Earth, you could work out actually just by trigonometry the distance to Venus and hence the whole scale of the solar system.
Okay, can I just ask while we've got this set up, are you going to go on to Halley and others?
Yes.
As a photo historian, what has always struck me about these kinds of photographs is that in order to make the photographs of the solar system scientific, in effect you have to kind of abstract what you're looking at. Because here we have these two perfect Euclidean spheres crossing each other. It's as if, even though photography is meant to show us how the world really is, in the hands of science, photography has to be turned into a kind of abstracting mechanism, basically so that it can be turned into a mathematical equation.
Well, it has to be turned into some measurable.
Yeah, so I mean, perhaps you could define, as a scientist, what is the realism of the photograph? Because a minute ago you were saying, well, it mattered to photograph it because it was an objective way of recording what had previously been imperfect observations.
Yes.
But in fact, the kind of photographs that are being made here are in effect, abstractions of what they're looking at, aren't they? I mean, this is not how the sun is. It's a boiling mass of fire and flame.
Yes. Well, of course, all imagery is, in that sense, only an abstraction. And actually, if I just to go to the very end, let me say that we're getting very familiar now with images in false colour. The background image of this region that's been called the Pillars of Creation is, I mean, first of all, we all know that in the dark we see in black and white, more or less, and its colour vision is only triggered when we have a high light level. So what does it mean to have true colour anyway of things in the night sky? But if the intensities were greater, we'd sort of see this thing, this structure in the disk of the Milky Way, more like it's shown in red, with the red light coming, in fact, from hydrogen atoms. But the picture that I've put on top of it in greens and yellows is produced by the Hubble Space Telescope. And it's in false colour in that the three colours, red, green and blue, have been used, in fact, to code various emissions from oxygen and nitrogen atoms in a certain stage of ionisation. And that has absolutely nothing to do with how the thing appears to us in the sky. But on the other hand, it's very informative as to what is the structure and temperature of the gas within in the thing. So the whole issue of representation occurs in a way, whatever you're doing, and
so are these photographs really being made as kind of touristic postcards?
Well. This one
it helps sell the Hubble Space Telescope.
Yes,
if we have
I think the answer is yes, they are, and they're also of scientific interest. I mean, it's not just that they're pretty pictures.
But it's interesting that Kepler basically gave us mathematical tables and calculations, and now we get.
Those were actually tables of measurements. They weren't calculations.
But now, is it because even science finds visual data easier to absorb, if you like, when it's been converted into a photographic image, than if we just got a whole string of figures or something?
Well, science, I don't know, but scientists.
Yes, okay.
certainly. The whole point of images like this false colour image is to bring out features that are not so easy to perceive if you essentially are provided with a columns and columns or a matrix of numbers. And of course it goes beyond that, because if we're looking, for example, in the images I just showed you, at least were collected, produced with light that we could detect with our eyes. But if you're using radio telescopes, you may produce images like the ones in the bottom left of a galaxy, Centaurus A, and I mean those are radio waves. There's nothing light or at all about it. Or here at the bottom right, a result of some computer simulations. In fact, of an early part of time when the universe was very very young, and colours have been used to represent actually there a two-dimensional projection of what's actually a three-dimensional volume of simulation.
So what does the blue, for example, represent in that image?
I have no idea.
But
the point is that...
chemical?
It's more likely to be either a state of ionisation, that's to say what fraction of the protons have got an electron attached to it, as opposed to what fraction of protons are just free. Mm-hmm. It may represent also density. I mean, there's probably several... There's an attempt there to represent several parameters at once.
So I think a lot of people who see these images reproduced in the illustrated press imagine we're looking at the universe as the eye might see it if we were magically up there.
But in fact, we see something completely different. And for example, the extraction of information like the sound is involved in introducing. Photography continued through... Well, perhaps I should just go back and show you these two.
You're going to talk about Halley.
This isn't Halley, but let me say that in 1874, astronomers didn't use photography. And this is why
I mean, I'm old enough that actually when I was a graduate student, I was taught how to take photographs, how to use the Herter and Driffield curve to try and calibrate them to get quantitative information of intensity out of photographs. But in 1874, astronomers didn't do that, essentially. And this is why they brought professional photographers with them on their expeditions. In 1882, this man, David Gill, who was the Astronomer Royal at the Cape of Good Hope in South Africa, took this photograph of a comet, the Great Comet of 1882, and he noticed that actually there were a whole load of stars there. Now, the stars are all little streaks, and that's probably partly because of the quality of the lens, but also because the comet is moving in the sky and the telescope had been adjusted to track the comet so as the comet wouldn't be blurred, although actually seeing that the nucleus, the very head, looks a bit blurred, maybe they didn't do it very well. But the stars are slight star trails for the same reason that in these photographs the stars are star trails. The sky has moved during the exposure. But it was realised you could actually use photographs to map the sky. And that was a whole load better that you took a photograph and then could look at it the following day and measure it in the warmth of your office with plenty of cups of coffee, rather than freezing at night trying to record the settings of the telescope as each star, one after the other, went by. So that was the beginning of actually astronomers beginning to apply photography. Here's the Pleiades, Matariki. Again, in the same decade, this Welsh astronomer, Isaac Roberts, took photographs and found that the Pleiades, which had been scrutinised by human eyes for millennia, actually, if you went to much lower light levels, were surrounded by great clouds of haziness. In fact, scattered light, we now know, due to presence of dust clouds. And that actually photography was going to reveal all sorts of things that you couldn't get with the human eye alone as a detector. And photography really reigned until about the 1980s in astronomy, when these devices, charge-coupled devices, began to appear. And those of you who've got the first generation of digital cameras, they have as their detector these things, charge-coupled devices. The greeny yellow thing was the one we had at Mount John. It was about the size of my thumbnail. At the time, that cost $5,000, I think, the chip, or was it £5,000 or five? It was £5,000 or others.
Too much money.
And the other $125,000 went for all the computer equipment. It had to be kept in this gold-coloured canister. You see, it's kept under vacuum. For astronomical use, we had to keep it at liquid nitrogen temperatures, so Karen there is trying to put liquid nitrogen into the canister, and it would take pictures like the one here, shown here at the left, here of stars in the small Magellanic Cloud, and from a sequence of these pictures you'd measure the intensity of the star you were interested in, HV2208 there at the top right hand corner, and then as a function of time you could plot this double dip graph, the variation. And so, indeed, what we're actually interested in as astronomers was the variation of the light, which you get from a whole sequence of observations that are like that. I used once a year or so to take my family up to Mount John, and what I would always do is unmount the detector from the telescope, actually attach an objective lens from a Pentax camera, and then photograph her. So here are a couple of photographs of my daughter, one with the gloves for manipulating liquid nitrogen. But it was all quite difficult because this thing was designed for low levels of light, and the slowest shutter speed you could have was 1 second. So we'd sit in the dark in the dome and try and take a second's exposure without moving. It took quite a while to get ones where we weren't blurred. But let me say, on the artistic point of view, this is, of course, before digital imagery became easily available. It immediately became clear to me that there were all sorts of artistic possibilities once you began to have digital images to manipulate. And also, actually, the with the way that scientists manipulate images. If you take a software like Photoshop, there are things that scientists do to images that Photoshop won't do. And so there are many more possibilities for manipulation of images than that scientists can think of, and indeed no doubt artists as well. So that was all I really had to say about images, except to say it's indeed we've moved a long way in astronomical imagery between Galileo's drawings of Saturn and now the ones produced by space probes, or even images of this particular galaxy, which that's an image taken, or composite of three images taken by a telescope in Hawaii, with much greater detail, much greater subtlety of image and so on.
William, you know way too much. We have a few minutes left. Yeah. If anybody has questions, we now have an expert resident. Pam?
Question, I'm fascinated by the discussion about false colour.
Mm.
And I'm wondering about, I love the idea that image was created with reference to the colour of chemistry, although chemical colours.
Mm.
Who decides to assign green to oxygen?
Oh, well, the scientist or whoever's making the image. And I mean, it's not as though there's any standardization, the international standard.
So a French and a Japanese astronomer might assign.
Oh, they might, absolutely, yes.
And why isn't there a universal?
And I think you also see, well, because essentially you need three or four colours to map the human visual colour space accurately. I believe it works much better with four, but we tend to use three. And so there's a lot of colours we can see that we can't actually reproduce.
But why don't scientists across the globe have a standard set of...
Because there's many, many...
why did our lights just go
out? There's many, many...
There's a lot of questions to be answered.
There's many, many atoms in many, many ionisation states that you might choose. So essentially there's a whole plethora of possibilities of things you might want to encode.
That seems like to be like an arbitrary aesthetic decision.
Absolutely, and indeed there's actually, if I go back to this galaxy M51 that we see at the bottom, there are even articles in the literature which are comparing the way that scientists produce their images for sort of scientific appreciation and interpretation with the somewhat more garish colours that the public relations offices tend to produce.
When I used to visit with my classes, and when I taught in New Mexico, we used to visit the Very Large Array, and the software geeks there told me that the colours were chosen by scientists who'd read Robert Heinlein's sci-fi novels when they were kids in the 50s, and the covers of those paperbacks is what informed their aesthetic choices. So that's really interesting to me, that there isn't a standard set of colour associations, because you'd think, if these are going to be scientifically useful, that scientists all over the world would have to recognise, well, green represents this ionisation and blue.
No, they have to read. They have to read the caption.
So they have to
recalibrate themselves each time.
Isn't that strange?
Well, I think it's not strange because there's too many options.
Shelton, you had a question.
I was just going to ask, at Terra May on the Orkney Islands, do any of those relics remain?
No, I do believe, though. Is Elliot Dawson here?
We do have some people around who have been there.
No. I believe that there's a few brick pillars on which the telescopes were built that remain. There's a stone on which the day before the expedition left in March, because they were there for another three months after the transit, where, in fact, the younger crone engraved German expedition, that's still there. But the buildings, I think, were probably actually dismantled and taken back, because they're in the newspapers at the time. There are people objecting to the fact that these buildings, having been bought prefabbed in Melbourne, were taken to Auckland Islands, and then the Australian Customs charged them import duty again when they brought them back to sell second hand in Melbourne. Yes.
You can't see past them.
Yeah. Or maybe it's those customs officers. Maybe one shouldn't particularly. Yeah.
We should just mention that relatively recently, parts of the Orkin Island have now been named after members of the expedition.
Ah, yes, there's two. If I go back, you go back to the map, the New Zealand Geographic Board, in about 2008, I think, named Venus Valley, Seeliger Creek, and Crone Creek. And I think Crone Creek is right, but I think this is Venus Valley, not that. And I think this is the one that the Germans called Seeliger Creek because of one of the photographs upstairs, which says this is a view of Seeliger Creek.
Seeliger was the expedition leader.
Leader, yes, just next to the dark room. And the dark room was here, so it seems to me this has to be Seeliger Creek, not that one. And let me say, you can read online the proposal that I don't know who made, although I have a short list of suspects, for officializing these names. And on the proposal, this is the one that's marked as Seeliger Creek. And I think even this one is marked as Venus Valley on the proposal. So why the New Zealand Geographic Board, or maybe it's the Map Service, have chosen other valleys and other creeks for Venus Valley and Seeliger Creek, I don't know. But you'll see that on the plates upstairs, there's a number that is, say, Venus Alta, is that right, Venus Valley? Yeah. And there is a picture of Seeliger Creek near the Dunkelkammer, near the dark room.
And Crone Creek, legend has it, was named because Johann's son fell into it by mistake.
Yes, that was how it was discovered.
That's how it was discovered.
The other ranks, at any rate, seem not to have had to work on a Sunday. They first landed on a Saturday, and so the Sunday they took off. And this place, Deer's Head, you'll see in some of the photographs upstairs, is actually looks very prominent. And so they went off towards Deer's Head on the Sunday, or at least the other ranks did, and Crone Junior fell in the creek.
Any other questions for?
I just had a bit of a question. I did a bit of amateur astronomy a few years back, and I remember pointing the telescope at the sun, and you know, you get that lovely circle of the sun shining on the card. And I might be wrong about this, but I seem to remember it being quite a definite edge that landed on the paper.
Yes, that's. I think is an issue to do with the size, although the size isn't necessarily so different from the size on these original glass plates that would have been about 10 centimetres as well. But the reality is, I mean, when I was, the diagram I showed you here, when I put that one together, I fully understood what they talked about the difficulty with the photographic plates of the time, that the edges weren't clear. And then there was also the issue that with a very short exposure, the circle of Venus was distorted as well, and so it was very difficult to determine where the centre of Venus was.
Can I ask, is there any scientific use to observing transit now, or is it just simply, I don't know, nostalgia?
If this was 2004, I'd have said not much, although there were, for example, measurements of this scattered light within instruments made, because when you have a very high contrast image, such as a dark black spot of Venus against the bright sun, you can learn a lot about how much light may be scattered in your image, reducing the contrast. But what's happened in the last 8 years is that astronomers have discovered lots of exoplanets, as they're called, planets orbiting other stars, and we're getting to the point where we may be able to detect fairly soon planets as small as the Earth or Venus. And then when we have detected such things, the next question will be, well, what's the nature of their atmosphere? Is it an atmosphere that's got oxygen in, like the Earth, and might have life on? Or is it a planet with an atmosphere of carbon dioxide like Venus, and therefore is unlikely to hold life? And as Venus moves across the disk of the Sun, some of the light passes through the higher atmosphere of the planet, and certain wavelengths characteristic of carbon dioxide are removed. So if you study these particular wavelengths, you can perhaps see that the planet has a carbon dioxide atmosphere. It's very difficult because, of course, you've got 1,000 times more light coming from the Sun than being absorbed by the atmosphere of Venus.
but it's a test bed for a, what we might be able to do in the future with exoplanets where there's far less light and the observation will be even more difficult, and equally a testbed for proposals of a, to the European Space Agency for a satellite for the 2020s to try and be able to do these observations on external, on exoplanets. So the they've come back into interest. I think you should never in science rule anything out as of no longer of any interest. Ideas may change and things may become, and in life generally, things may become pertinent.
Well, there you go.
Again,
a little philosophy to finish our hour. I actually have to go to class, so I just want to thank William so much for coming. We're just very lucky that he happens to be here visiting from France on the day of the transit in the middle of the Dark Sky exhibition and available to share his obviously great depths of expertise with us. I have to go and teach because that's what Vic pays me to do, but William's happy to hang around and talk informally, answer more questions. I hope you'll all go and look at the exhibition again. I'm going to hand over to Tina Barton as moderator while I depart, but thank you so much for coming.
You're welcome.
Well, my students in 319 had better get to classes.
Yes, I think the formal part is now over. I just wanted to thank Jeff and William for a fascinating talk. I wanted to also mention that we do have a webcast of the actual transit that's taking place right now on the computer screen on the desk upstairs, if anyone would like to stop and look at that. We've also made up some little souvenir packages with a copy of the catalogue, some special viewing glasses, and a set of postcards, which are available at the desk upstairs. And do please take a copy of the public programme. We've got another month to go with the exhibition and an interesting, exciting lineup of events that are still about to unfold. I'd also just like to acknowledge Te Papa Tongarewa, Museum of New Zealand, who I understand facilitated William's visit.
Paid the effort.
And also helped us mount this amazing display of Eric Lee Johnson's photographs that we're sitting amongst. Do please come and look at the show, spend some time, enjoy yourselves, and thank you all for coming today.
Actually, what I could perhaps do for those of you who are interested, if I can get back into Jeff's slides, I can actually just tell you a little bit about some of the photographs that are in the panels upstairs, because then when you look at them, maybe they'll mean a bit more, says he. No, well, that doesn't seem to be him. So, it seems to have disappeared. And where have I gone? Oh, here we are. That's him. There he is. So, let's do slideshow, probably. Slideshow. From current slide. A general view of the site. This was a tide gauge for measuring the tides. There were numerous wrecks on the Auckland Islands. This is the shelter that survivors from the General Grant, who was wrecked in 1866, built. This is a view from one of the islands to the north of Auckland Island. Let's go to the next one. This is the French ship, the sailing ship that they came on. So for instance, when they went back, it took them something like 22 days to have the relevant winds to take them back to Melbourne. These are more of the where the shipwreck people went. In fact, the New Zealand government were upset about the number of shipwrecks on the Auckland Islands and also on the other subantarctic islands. And so in the end of the 1860s, they made 6 monthly visits to search for possible shipwrecks. And they also put down food dumps, and this is a food dump with its triangle marker that has fallen down. And this, I do believe, although it's not identified as such, I think in 1909, Croner is wrong. This is a shelter that has put up to await shipwrecked people.
They were clearly having the perils of the sea. This is someone who probably died, probably as a body was found, and this is probably a shipwreck victim. The other thing that's noticeable from Kroner is that he took a lot of photographs of the Metro cedarous trees, the southern rata, and certainly towards the end of the time they were there, they must have all been red, and they must have seemed like an absolutely, one can understand his obsession with these trees, that he seems to have photographed them such a lot. The caption here says the shepherd in his hut. I didn't see the hut, but there was a shepherd and his wife, who I discovered here was called Alfred Nelson, on the island. And one of the Kroner photographs shows, one of the Wolfram photographs shows one of the naval officers stroking a little lamb. The Wolfram photographs you can find online on the website of the State Library of Victoria. Anyway, so that's just a brief remarks about some of the pictures you can see upstairs.
But if there are other questions you'd like to ask, I'm happy to. Yes.
Yes. And you've almost got that kind of drop. If the margin of the sun is somewhat thinner, is that a better kind of place, like you can zero in on the outer portion of these things? You're breathing against the main fringes of the sun.
Well, I think ultimately none of them are very good. What was discovered in the transit in 1761, because essentially the history of the transits of Venus is one deception after another, really, was that there were two effects that could affect the timing of this moment of just of the two edges being tangent. One was that actually Venus gets surrounded by a bright sort of aureole, and that's the light of the sun being refracted through the atmosphere. So that's the aureole, which therefore makes it a bit difficult to know what the edge of the planet is when all of a sudden the edge of the planet has become a sort of bright ring. But then as it comes onto the planet, onto the disk itself, and the bright ring actually becomes less visible because it's sort of lost in the brightness of the sun, it seemed that the edges of Venus and the sun were sort of linked together by a sort of sticky ligament, and that's the black drop, which made it very difficult to say, well, this is the time at which they were just tangent to each other. And 1874, the belief was that actually tracking across the disk of the sun, and in fact there was, in 1874, there was also another instrument that was used, which was called a heliometer, not a photoheliograph, but a heliometer, which was a special telescope with the front lens sawn in two, and by moving those two halves of the lens, you could make a series of measurements to try and, using your eye, not using photographs, measure the distance between the centre of the sun and the centre of Venus, and therefore measure the track across the sun rather than just measuring these points of contact. But ultimately, Halley, whose idea it was to use transits of Venus, hoped it would produce the distance of the sun accurate to one part in 500. The 18th century transits produced values that were that disagreed by 10%, so you didn't really have a value that was any better than 10%. The 19th century transits disagreed by 1%. They never got down to the 0.2% that Halley had hoped for. And already, in fact, at the time of the 19th century, the transits, there were other methods becoming available which actually looked more promising. And for instance, the French celestial mechanician Urban Le Verrier thought it was a waste of time going to observe the transits in the 19th century. The Russians went in 1874, but they didn't go to observe it in 1882. And other methods, both the discovery of the minor planet Eros, which comes closer than Venus does, and in addition is a tiny little point, so it's much easier to triangulate in a telescope, in roughly 1900, and there was another campaign in the 1930s, reduced the uncertainty of the distance of the sun to something like 0.01%, one part in 10,000. Post-World, there was also the improved analyses of all the perturbations of the planetary orbits. I think many of you may know that the planet Uranus and then the planet Neptune were discovered by looking at interpreting the fact that the planets, the known planets, didn't move quite in perfect ellipses because there are other gravitational forces besides the force of the Sun on them. But there was another message which Léon Foucault, the man that I wrote the biography of, not the autobiography, so it felt like it sometimes that it was not the biography of, he actually measured the speed of light in the laboratory, and in physics textbooks it's often presented as this was the first laboratory measurement of the speed of light, and it's true, but it's the suggestion is we now know that the speed of light is an important constant of physics, important in electromagnetism, important in relativity, and that's why Foucault measured it. Not at all. Foucault was financed by the Paris Observatory to make this measurement because the speed of light linked with a constant known as the constant of aberration also gave you the distance to the Sun. So there were other methods coming up already at the end, already in the middle of the 19th century, suggesting that the geometrical method of transits of Venus was perhaps not the best thing to do. But there was, I suppose, for 1874, it wasn't quite so clear. By 1882, I think that there were a significant number of observations. In 1882, it was just a bit matter of inertia that they went and did it. But then subsequently, after World War II, there were things like planetary radar reflections, sending a radar beam to Venus and listening to the echo. The trouble with those is that the beam reflects off the whole hemisphere of Venus, so you have to make a correction for the topography. But once people began sending spacecraft, you could have transponders, so you send a radio signal to the spacecraft, which immediately signals you back, and the spacecraft is nice and tiny. So we ultimately, as a result of all this, well, there's two things to say. The distance to the Sun is an ill-defined quantity because we on the Earth are buffeted by all these gravitational forces. So there was a time when we talked about the average distance to the Sun, but the average distance to the Sun from one year to the next varies because, for instance, our position is pulled by the Moon, and you know that the Moon isn't in any way synchronized with the Earth, so some years were closer on average than others. But ultimately, the scale factor of the solar system is now known to an uncertainty of about 3 meters in 150 million kilometers. So it's actually a number that is known to incredible accuracy, although that isn't quite the same thing as saying we know the distance to the Sun is. Yes. But it's this improvement of understanding space and time that has led to, indeed, interplanetary navigation, but GPSs. The fact that I can, with my camera, taking a picture, have my camera tell me where I am on the surface of the Earth and get it more or less right, is just absolutely incredible. And it's a result of all these improvements in surveying, navigation, understanding the nature of space and time, that it has become possible. And the transits of Venus, I think, are absolutely a link in this scientific, the development of this scientific understanding that has resulted in what we now know.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. So much to
learn. Perfect, thank you so much.
Yeah.
Where are you based?
In France, in Brittany.
Oh.